Before we begin, I should ask you one question. What prompted you to come out with a new James Bond book?
I didn't come out with a new James Bond book. Thank you.
You mean we have the wrong garden?
I wish I had.
Oh, but you said the booking was.
It would have been nice.
I have to tell you something funny before we begin. John Gardner was here. British John Gardner was here for an interview. Came to the States. And he said that he had accidentally gotten one of your royalty checks.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he looked at it and he said, I was not very impressed.
Yes, not. Not compared to his. No. No, that's true.
Well, what would Aquinas say, though, of the other John Gardner's books? There is, I guess one of the things, that we'll probably end up back and forth and with no necessarily logical progression,
right.
But... one of the things that I've been thinking about rereading your things and just thinking about, because I'm involved with music a great deal,
mm-hmm.
is the return to romanticism that we seem to be. It hasn't necessarily caught up with the critical world yet, but mm-hmm. it seems very evident in the mm-hmm. in the creative world. In classical music, it's certainly evident.
Right.
We've gotten
right.
out of that academic
mm-hmm.
thing, and people who never would have written romantic works like Rochberg and Penderecki
sure.
are now writing
sure.
lush.
Sure. Even Jacob Druckmann.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Schifrin, even yeah. those strong feelings.
Sure.
I wonder if you think that, is this just a little kind of, is this just a little peak or valley, or is this something that is happening, a return to sanity?
I don't know if it's a return to sanity, but I think basically what happens is that people get tired of what they've been doing, you know, and you start listening to the other side. I mean, Boulez was starting to do Brahms, you know, last year in Philharmonic. I think you just get tired. And Barthelme's writing very moving stories these days, you know, so.
But it would seem to be more than that, because one of the things that people have been arguing in defense mm-hmm. of all of this mm-hmm. in the past was, well, yes, this is the logical progression.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that we happen to be writing music devoid right. of feeling, or that we happen to be placing technique first.
Right.
It is that is the next step.
That's true. That's true. And, of course, the problem with that next step is that you abandon emotion to do it, you know, to some extent. Boulez talks about how moving his stuff is, but nobody believes it, you know. And you look at Rothko paintings and he says it's powerfully moving, and many art critics do, but people don't think that, you know.
Mm.
And gradually, if the people don't think you're moving, you start feeling you're not doing something that you should be doing. Maybe that's the reason, maybe it's not. I don't know how much the relationship between the artist and the public has to do with it. But I do think that the artist himself, one way or another, when he starts emphasizing one piece of his character and not the other pieces, begins to feel something missing, and then he starts compensating, and maybe overcompensating, I don't know. I think it is certainly true. The books that I've been getting lately in galleys, you know, to do blurbs for or something like that, all one after another are lyrical and moving. Some of them are sort of puffballs, sort of sweet Pollyanna-ish puffballs, always with the obligatory sad scene, but, you know. And some of them are very dark. Some of them are dark light, like the White Hotel. Beautiful, wonderful book, I think. As I said on the blurb, and then some are, you know, like Surviving the Flood, a book about Noah, which is a kind of sweet book. You know, it ends with the rainbow and, you know, covenant and all this kind of stuff. I don't know. It's very complicated. It has to do with economics. It has to do with the social situation. It has to do with a certain sadness that we have about El Salvador and our peculiar position. You know, conservatism on one hand is a very good thing for us economically. On the other hand, it commits us to all kinds of horrible monsters that we hope to be free of. And all of this comes out in the arts. So I don't know. People getting married again, I'm told. You know, it's weddings all over the place. Churches, you can't find room. You know, there's always a swing back, I guess.
But there is always a swing back. But this, for some reason, seems, maybe I'm making too much mm-hmm. of it, but because when I was growing up, and you wrote 12 tone or die.
Mm-hmm.
Even
mm-hmm.
though late Schoenberg, he was right. beginning to go in the piano concerto. You
yeah,
can
no.
hear, what is this? And yeah. you can see the same thing in all the arts.
That's
now
right.
and in society and all those hard, etched in stone
mm-hmm.
Arguments
mm-hmm.
That there was the laugh at Schoenberg, who said there's a lot mm-hmm. of good things to be written in mm-hmm. C major,
mm-hmm.
and the laughing at novelists
mm-hmm.
who
mm-hmm.
said there are still romantic stories to be told.
Sure.
We're at a movie which I think said something about what's been popular lately. We went to see, my wife likes to see garbage every once in a while. Mm-hmm. Admittedly, she'll say, let's see something awful.
I love garbage. Yeah.
She took us to Oliver's Story.
Mm-hmm.
The continuing. Now, what do you say about two books, like the two Eric Siegel books, where the first one, the whole bit is this nasty, cursing woman with seemingly no redeemable features at all, except the fact that she is dying, seems to be the redeemable feature. Is followed up by a book in which this loathsome man is left behind, gets entangled with this woman who doesn't seem to have any particularly redeeming features either. They yell at each other and break up at the end. Mm-hmm. And these are books that sold millions of copies. Mm-hmm. Well,
I have no explanation for that. I have no explanation for anybody reading that at all, but no, I don't understand it. I only know sort of what kind of feelings I go through as a writer, and I know to some extent what my students go through. The kinds of things they get sick of, or the kind of things they don't want to compete with or like. But it's very hard to tell what's happening all over the country. I visit California, I don't understand those people at all. I mean, I really love them, but they don't think like me, you know. And the Midwest certainly doesn't think like the East.
You can't relate?
Yeah, I think I can relate, sort of. You know, not really, no. But it's a big country, and different movements go on different places. New York for a long time controlled the writing scene in a sort of way, and I don't think it does now to the same extent. Mm-hmm. That may not be true, but I think it is.
I wanted to ask you about that. This is the center of the publishing industry, and many of the great writers have either lived here or worked here at one time. In fact, William Styron was in about 2 weeks ago and talked to me, and while he lives in Connecticut, he does keep an apartment here, and he comes in every week or 2 weeks, and he just loves the vibrancy of New York. Mm-hmm. Yet you have a very rural existence. You would never.
I do.
Yeah. You would never consider coming to New York, and
I wouldn't have an apartment in New York. I wouldn't be able to afford it. But I haven't had a Sophie's Choice either, so or any other kind of choice. But anyhow, I don't think I would enjoy having an apartment in New York. But it's certainly a joy to come to New York. And I certainly agree with him. You know, it is vibrant. You know, well, I sometimes have to pass through New York on the train. It makes me cry to keep going. You know, it'd be much nicer to just get off and stand on the platform for a while.
You have no anti-New York bias?
Oh, no, I don't. I think sometimes the New York literary establishment accidentally, I don't think by any conscious plot, forces things down people's throats that people don't really want. I don't think New York is as much in touch with the world as it could be. But that's partly because it's hard to get the papers around. Like, the New York Times is the king of book reviews in this part of the country. It isn't as good by any means as a book review, in my opinion, as the Lone Star Review, which is the largest circulating review book review in the world, which covers all the big papers in Texas, as I understand. In any case, they really let you say what you want to say, and they don't gang up on a writer. They don't give writers' works to enemies or close friends or whatever. I think that that kind of thing happens, accidentally in the New York Times, but it simply doesn't elsewhere. Los Angeles Times never takes the same view, almost never takes the same view, as everybody likes the Confederacy of Dunces. You know, how could you not? I mean, it's a beautiful, wonderful book with a sad story behind it. But sometimes the establishment makes me a little nervous in New York, but not the people of New York and certainly not the publishing industry. I think they are trying very hard to publish good books, and I think they're doing it.
Yeah, the sway really is held. Even when I lived in Chicago, we would get the New York Times Book Review on Sunday, and the New York Review of Books, and a lot of people's cocktail party opinions were shaped by the people whose opinions, I think you said once, would make an intelligent cow suspicious.
I should say that. I see a lot of foolish things.
The Art of Living did get mixed reviews, but perhaps part of it is that most critics will look at you in a much sterner light than they would another writer fiction. So are you braced for this kind of literary criticism?
Yeah, well, no. Of course, nobody's ever braced for harsh criticism, but it is absolutely true that I set myself up in writing that book on moral fiction and telling the world what I think fiction ought to be doing, should have been doing during the 70s and so on. And in mentioning specific writers and saying what I thought their faults were, and not going on to say in great detail what I thought their virtues are, although I think they're all great writers, I wouldn't have mentioned them, I seem to be saying I'm better than all of those. That's absolutely not true. It would be terribly embarrassing to throw myself in with that group and say what my faults are. I mean, it just would sound like I'm blowing my own horn or something. But it is true that in pointing out what some problems have been in fiction, I set myself up to be taken very seriously, and if I don't measure up to the standard, that I hold as an ideal for myself and for everybody else, a standard that very few of us actually reach, although there have been books, some books recently that I think absolutely reach it. The Way to Othello is one, Benjamin Tamas's new book, which Book of the Month Club is bringing out, Minotaur is another, and Ron Hansen is doing it, and there are good books. Nevertheless, if I set up this high ideal and then I don't quite reach it, I can't feel too badly when somebody yells at me for, in his opinion, not reaching it. I think I'm better than they say, but the point is right enough.
Well, you've been critical of John Updike for, I believe you said, he doesn't revise enough and he feels it necessary to have a book every year, but actually you've been coming out with about a book a year.
Yeah.
Ever since the, about 1970.
Right. I've picked on John Updike in a way that makes it seem that I like him less than I do. I mean, I think he's a genius. Absolutely an original and brilliant man. I do think he writes too fast. He has a feeling that the business of a writer is to keep producing books, and he's right. You know, one pays one's dues by writing books that people like, love even, and he has done that. I do wish he would write a little more slowly. Well, he is now. You know, lately he isn't bringing them out one a year, and I have immense hopes for what he's doing. I've been bringing out books fast, but two things are involved there. One is that I spent a long time with books in the drawer because at first it was very hard for me to sell my books. I had waiting, before I sold anything, I had Grendel and The Virtue of Agathon and Sunlight Dialogues and The Resurrection, four books, and a version of Nickel Mountain, which thank God I didn't publish. Bad enough for one I did publish. But anyway, I had a lot of books in the drawer. I worked very, very slowly, usually about 10 years to a book, but little by little they've been coming out. That's one factor. The other factor is I got better. That is to say, I've gotten better in some ways and worse in some ways. I don't take as long anymore to figure things out. I mean, I've been through it enough times that I'm beginning to learn the art. I think that this book that I've just brought out, The Art of Living, is as good as I can do in the short story. I think it's pretty good. I think there are stories in that are really masterful, and I think there are stories that are a little weaker. Some of them aren't very ambitious in the first place. I think the book that I'm bringing out in the spring is a really good novel. It's the best thing I've written, and I'm working on one which I started in 1974, which I'll be through in about 5 years, which I think is better than that one. But I've been working faster lately. I spend more time now than I used to. I had a very hectic life, and I've got a very subtle rural life now where I have to do nothing except once in a while mow the lawn and feed a pig and feed the dog and write, and I do it morning, noon, and night.
I find you very chameleon-like in many respects, because The Art of Living, there's a story in there that I think is called The Joy of the Just, which reads to me like Eudora Welty.
Really an imitation of Faulkner, but
so is she.
Right.
You sound like John Updike in the one called... Stillness Too, I think it was one in St. Louis.
Stillness, right.
And that
is
had a kind of a John Updike tone to me. And in the one about the composer, the music lover, that sounded a little bit like John Hawkes.
Maybe. Well, I'm not conscious of the John
Maybe Jerzy Kosinski little bit. I'm not kidding. To it to me.
The music lover, I was really imitating Thomas Mann. I imitate a lot, and that's a part of what I do. My real imitation of John Updike is in a book called The King's Indian, a story, Pastoral Care, where I was really carefully doing it. I discovered a lot about Updike's writing in that. I realized that he's incredibly good sentence by sentence, and I'm not. You know, I'm one of those people who throws paint at the canvas, you know. I paint at a big wall, kind of, so that... That's why he's a great short story writer, and I'm only an ordinary, serious short story writer. There aren't very many of those left either, but anyhow, he's more elegant than I am. Nobody can touch him in elegance, I don't think. Nobody living, nobody in any country can touch him. Maybe Italo Calvino, but not many. But I do imitate. It's certainly true.
I think that since we are not going to have too much more time, we ought to spring the... surprise for Mr. Gardner.
This is a spring of a surprise.
Terrific.
Going back... when we were talking about on moral fiction and criticism of other authors, we had Dr. Rupp a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know you were coming here, so this wasn't, let's do this because John will be here.
Mm-hmm.
But we asked him about his reaction to the criticism of him in on moral fiction. Mm-hmm. And if you have, I think, 2 minutes, this is what he had to say.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that First of all, in terms of the paucity of first-rate works of fiction, I agree. I mean, in any given time, there are very few really good things done in any art.
Mm-hmm.
Very few good symphonies written and dances danced. But in terms of the identification of what is good or first-rate with what is moral, that's either inarguable as well, I mean, and self-evident, or leads to a kind of Comstockian view of literature and fiction and poetry and everything else, and the presumption is someone is going to tell us who among the artists is moral and who is immoral. What's latent in that whole point of view is the impulse to become a commissar in the Republic of Letters. We don't have commissars in the Republic of Letters, at least not in this country.
Are you saying that morality has nothing to do with art?
Well, morality has everything to do with art, but every serious artist will maintain that he produces his work with integrity and making it as true and fine as he possibly can. And the trouble comes when one critic uses moralistic standards or his own standards, which he objectifies and in some godlike way, in order to judge his peers. And I happen to think Gardner is primarily, I suppose, a fiction writer, and that when a writer does a work of this sort, it usually turns out to be some sort of rationale for his own work. And he, of course, comes up meeting his own standards very well, you see.
Not trying to start a fight.
No.
What do you think?
I don't think I meet my standards very well. I think almost everything that Dr. said is right. It's certainly true that the risk is that a book like that will make it seem that one person is the judge, you know, what's art. I certainly didn't mean that. I don't say that in the book. My feeling is that everybody should judge morally or whatever way he wants to judge. But he should judge. You know, he should not feel that he's the victim of a publishing establishment or of a feeling in the country or anything else. I do feel, and I say in moral fiction, that there's a temptation in every age to write in a certain way. In the Pollyanna age, all the hack writers wrote happy-ending, sappy books. The very same writers in the 60s and 70s wrote nihilistic, gloomy books. Mm-hmm. They're the same people, you know. It's sentimentality on either side. I think that Dr. O is absolutely right that if anyone gets the idea that somebody, certainly I hope it's not me, but somebody should sit in judgment, you know, that's a terrible thing. But I think if everybody sits in judgment, then it's a good thing. I think that the book on moral fiction, I made mistakes in that book, and that, you know, that's too bad. That is to say, I misunderstood a couple of books, and those are really stupid. You know, I'm a reader, but I read fast, and I miss things, you know. But I think the general principle that one should make a stand, one should say, you know, this is a good book, this is not a good book, one should try to be honest about it, self-critical in a nice moralist sense, that's a good principle, and I think that people have been using it a good deal more since that book came out. I'm sorry that my name was even on the book. I mean, I tried to tell the truth in that book, and I tried to tell it gently. It didn't come out gently all the time. You know, some people were hurt. I don't think writers are ever angry at you. They just hurt, especially if what you say is true. The other thing is that book has been misused, mishandled a lot. When people say, among others, John Gardner castigates Saul Bellow, etc., it's simply not true. Never in my life have I ever castigated Saul Bellow. I think he's the greatest living American writer. He's far beyond me. I think he's a mighty mensch of a man. And I say he has a fault in his fiction, which is that he doesn't dramatize enough. That he tends to lecture, but that's not a very bad fault. I mean, my hero is my two heroes, Jane Austen and Tolstoy, and both of them, Jane in her subtle way and Tolstoy in his not so subtle way, lecture all the time, and that's a fault. You know, Dostoevsky's better; he doesn't lecture. You know, or if he does lecture, watch him. You know, because he's not telling you the truth. But I agree with what Doctor has to say, and I certainly don't mean to set that book up as a statement of my values. In fact, the books that I've published recently, in Freddie's book, a novel that I brought out, or a construction, is certainly not moral in my terms. I mean, I wish it were, but it just came out the way it came out, and it's not a happy, moral, you know, affirmative book. The Art of Fiction has a lot of gloomy stuff in it, and the book I have coming out next year is practically nihilistic. I don't like that. I just have to write the book that I have to write.
I find it incredible to learn that the Sunlight Dialogues have been in a drawer somewhere, and you dust it off.
It was thought to be too long. Also, it's not completely realistic.
81 characters.
That's still just the ones I listed.
Right, yeah. You went through that same sort of thing Martin Eden did when, after the first thing came out and everything, people started saying, what else have you got that you've been mm-hmm. putting away that we didn't look at before?
Well, it was funny. Finally, there was a man named David Siegel who liked my stuff, and he just took it all. And so he published the first thing in the American Library, and then he moved to Harper, and the second was published there, and he moved to Knopf and died, unfortunately, for the world, because he found an awful lot of good writers, just wonderful writers, Bill Gass and others.
Well, how did it happen? The Resurrection was your first book, I think, 1966?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But you were 33 at that mm-hmm. at that time. So you must have been doing a lot of writing up until
That's
you
right.
finally sold
That's right.
the Resurrection. Did you submit the manuscripts? Did you get constant rejections? How did it work during
yeah.
this period?
Yeah, I submitted them everywhere. I had an agent for a while who was not, at that time, he was very young. He wasn't very effective at that time. He's a very good agent now. He's not my agent anymore. The books that Dave Siegel finally took, I brought in a paper bag, two shopping bags, actually, like one of those ladies, and dumped on his desk, and, because I thought if I came in person, he'd be scared of me, and he was, and took them.
And you were never discouraged after?
Oh, sure, I was discouraged. It was terrible. I stopped writing fiction for a while, and I started writing poetry, and I knew that my fiction was quite original. At the time, it was extremely original, and the poetry I wrote was clearly derivative and a little stupid, in fact. And I never got a poem rejected. And that made me furious, because I knew they were mediocre. And I knew that the fiction wasn't. And I thought I was going to be doomed by the stupidity of my age to be a poet, you know, because I wanted to publish something. But I was wrong about the age.
You came under fire in a magazine called The American Book Collector.
Mm.
Criticized you broadly for publishing three limited editions,
mm-hmm.
An outfit, I believe, in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
One was, I can't remember the other two, one was Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
And they felt that this was exploitative, that mm-hmm. these books should never have come out in a high-cost
mm-hmm.
Production. Are you satisfied with those books? Do you accept this criticism? Sure.
Well,
no,
I understand the criticism, and it's a very common criticism. Those books that came out there are opera libretti, which nobody else would publish. And the people who buy from those companies are essentially collectors. Most people who publish for collectors publish expensively made books which aren't necessarily the best books of the writer. In fact, often the stuff that the writer couldn't normally sell. And then sock it to the collectors, and the collectors are willing because that's the game they're playing. They're betting on somebody. And the question is, you know, do you bring out too many and wreck your market, or, you know, et cetera. But the press that I brought those books out with was not like that. As a matter of fact, that was a Robin Hood kind of press. They were ripping off the rich to pay the poor. What that press did, it was the New London Press, which is now Pressworks, or at least the editors involved have gone to Pressworks, were publishing expensive collector volumes, and with the money bringing out fiction of new people, and I was all for it. So that was, it was a good thing, I thought. I did bring out one with Herb Yellen in California, who was the normal kind of collector thing, but we had an understanding that the story I brought out, which was Limp the Box Painter, would come out in The Art of Fiction.
William Styron said something very revealing. Previous to talking to Styron, I was talking to Vonnegut,
mm-hmm.
who told me that he had to give up drinking completely because it was destroying his mind. So I put the drinking question to Styron, who said, well, he likes drinking, and in fact, he finds drinking enhances his artistic powers. What position do you take on this?
Well, I think that for Kurt, drinking is a very bad thing, because Kurt is a very passionate guy, and he can't stop, I think, you know, and a very wonderful, funny, depressive kind of fellow. He's probably right that he shouldn't drink. I don't think that's true of Styron. I think Styron is a high-class good old boy who can handle it. And I think there's no question. As I read Styron, I think he's a wonderful writer. Just incredible stuff, imagination. And the control of fact is just astonishing. I think what Styron does, this is just my guess, but I think he finds things when he's writing a little drunk that he never would have found sober. And in the morning he goes through, you know, cold sober, corrects the excesses, you know. But I think Styron has a kind of freaky genius that you almost can't get sober. I mean, I know a lot about writer trance states and that kind of stuff. And I'm sure that Styron, like Faulkner, makes use of a kind of inhibition breaker that he's lucky he's able to control. I